from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup in Portland. All ages are welcome to this benefit show featuring Mike Crenshaw and Rashid Jamal to raise funds and awareness for their November trip to various countries in Africa. Again, that's a benefit show for the African Hip Hop Caravan on Saturday, August 29th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup, 9022 North Newman Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Peace.
It's the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan is the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And here comes the food show.
Some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Rachel Bennett. On today's show, we'll hear from Kristen Olson, author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. To follow up on the subject of soil, we'll speak with Richard Satnick of Dick's Kitchen about the holistic food movement. We'll hear from Andrew Barton and Peter Schweitzer from Secret Restaurant about their new project, and we'll also hear from Annie Moss from Sea Star Bakery about the unique business she has running in Northeast Portland. To begin the show, we'll listen to an interview I recorded with Kristen Olson discussing her book, The Soil Will Save Us. The book discusses the dire importance of healthy soils. Healthy soils are alive with microorganisms, bacteria, fungi, and nematodes that have evolved in a symbiotic relationship with plants over the millennia. Healthy soils affect a wide range of other issues that we face today by helping to maintain drought resistance, scrubbing toxic materials and excess fertilizer, which keeps our waters cleaner. Healthy soils allow plant life to flourish and sequester carbon dioxide, which has the potential to decrease levels found in the atmosphere. Here's the interview with Kristen Olson discussing her book. So tell me a little bit about what is happening in the soil.
Well, that's the most important thing of all. I mean, this whole subject, I knew nothing about it. When people used to say that the soil was alive, I thought of it as being somewhat metaphorical and somewhat spiritual and somewhat poetic to say that. But it's really true. In a teaspoon of healthy soil, there's between 1 billion and 6 billion microorganisms, these tiny, tiny things that we can't see and that until really recent in our history as human beings, we just haven't been aware of. We might have seen the effects of them. Like when we make wine, we see the effects of microorganisms. And when we make cheese and when we make sauerkraut, we see the effects of those microorganisms. But we really haven't understood much about them until fairly recently. So there is this incredible life in the soil that's kind of the foundation for all the rest of life as we know it. So these microorganisms have been around for billions of years, been in the soil for billions of years. Plants, ever since they moved from the seas to land, which was about a half a billion years ago, have had this relationship with these soil microorganisms. So, plants are sending out roots into the soil, But it's for more than to search for water and more than to just hold them in place. Plants through photosynthesis are making, you know, they're taking carbon dioxide out of the air and they're making a carbon fuel, which is what they use to grow. But they are also sharing almost half of that carbon fuel through their roots. They're leaking it out through their roots to these soil microorganisms, which are flocking, you know, like commuters coming to the city around each plant, you know, just flocking over to these, to the roots of the plants to get their share of this carbon sugar. And so that's what the plant is giving. That's what the plant, it's a partnership. So that's what the plant is giving the soil microorganisms. And in exchange, the soil microorganisms are bringing plants nutrients that they have farmed out in the soil from pieces of rock and salt, silt and clay and sand. They've extracted nutrients, mineral nutrients from those pieces of rock, and they're bringing them to the plants. That's how plants get fertilized in nature. You know, they, you know, if you go out into the woods or out into a meadow where humans haven't messed it up, you see plants growing like crazy without the use of fertilizer. You know, they don't need fertilizer. It's those microorganisms that are fertilizing plants in nature. So that's part of the partnership, is plants are feeding the soil microorganisms carbon sugar and the microorganisms are bringing plants nutrients. But the microorganisms are also, you know, plants can tell them, I'm facing a disease in some part of the plant, you know, and they can send with those through their roots, through those exudates, that carbon fuel that they're sending out through their roots, they can signal the microorganisms to help them, help defend them against insect pests, against other pests. And it's a very complicated relationship, and it's completely essential to life as we know it.
In your book, you recount a number of stories of your travels where you see firsthand the transformation of degraded lands into spaces with healthy soils. Tell us about some of the experiences that you had.
Oh, well, I traveled to Zimbabwe, where a biologist and a range manager there named Alan Savory has been studying the impact of animals on the land. And, you know, a lot of people believe that cattle, that grazing cattle is something that destroys land. And he used to believe that until he had studied it some more. Anyway, he came up with this whole method of moving grazing animals, herbivores, over the land so that they replicate the behavior of ancient herds. Because, you know, all the great grasslands of the world, those co-evolved with grazing animals. You know, here in the United States, where we've got the Great Plains, we've got some of the best soil and grasslands in the world. And, you know, those co-evolved with those huge herds of moving buffalo and bison. So Alan Savory developed a method that farmers who have cows can employ, that it replicates that behavior of ancient herds, which is actually good for the land. These animals, if they don't stay in one spot for too long, they keep moving the way the ancient herds did. They actually are fertilizing the land and making it richer and breaking down old dead grass, pushing it down into the earth where the microorganisms can get at it. They have a beneficial effect on the land. So that was one thing I saw in Africa where, because of the work he's been doing with local grazers, there was land that had been really ruined by overgrazing, by poor grazing, and it was being brought back to life. Streams were starting to return to the land. It was really exciting to see all that. And then I went to Australia to visit a bunch of farmers there who were working on some of these soil health approaches. And, you know, some of them were farming on the equivalent of sand dunes. I mean, really, there was hardly anything of what you would recognize as soil. You dig down a little bit and there's sand. But through practicing a lot of these soil health techniques. And, you know, there are about 40 different things that people do that can help build up healthy soil, but there's sort of three main principles. You know, one is disturb the soil as little as possible, you know, so the kind of tilling that we typically see, you know, when you're out driving along the highways and there are farms on either side and, you know, farmers are out there on this big equipment just opening up the earth and there's that soil blowing away in the wind. That's not a good thing. You know, we want to disturb the soil as little as possible because when we till, when we claw open the earth, it disrupts those communities of soil microorganisms. And it also exposes that carbon that they have built up in the soil to the oxygen, and it sort of volatilizes it and it blows off as carbon dioxide. So we want to disturb the soil as little as possible. We want to keep the soil as densely covered as possible. So any bare soil is pretty much a human artifact. I mean, in nature, soil doesn't stay bare for very long. You know, maybe there's a fire, maybe there's a landslide, and the soil is bare for a while, but nature quickly covers that over again. But it's only human impact where you see large stretches of naked, empty, hungry soil. So we want to keep the soil covered as much as possible with vegetation, and we want to keep the soil covered as much as possible with diverse vegetation. So that is also one of the problems of conventional industrial agriculture, is that they've, you know, you drive past these fields that are just like one thing, only one thing growing for acre after acre, mile after mile. And that is so antithetical to the way things happen in nature, where you could have 100 different plants in a square foot of land.
So another reason why this is so important to maintain the soil health is they think, or they're positing, that the soil can actually capture carbon and hold carbon, which in turn would help with global warming to some degree.
Right, yeah. I mean, the world's soils have lost, ever since humans started to farm, it started to practice agriculture, which is about 10,000 years, the impact that we've had on the land. Even back then, when it was just oxes pulling wooden plows through the ground, even that has had its negative impact on our climate, on our planet. So as long as we've been practicing agriculture, we have been opening up the soil and exposing the carbon that those soil microorganisms fix in the ground. So they've gotten that carbon. When they take carbon, that carbon fuel from the plants, and plants have taken that carbon out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis. So the microorganisms fix that, a large percentage of that carbon in the soil. And pretty much everything that we do in conventional agriculture releases that carbon that's been built up in the soil and turns it back into carbon dioxide. So yeah, I mean, it's if you think about we've got what's called the legacy load of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it's up at around 400 parts per million now. And, you know, scientists have been saying for a long time that 350 parts per million is a safe and acceptable amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and past that, we really risk catastrophic climate change. But the thing is that the climate movement has, I think, erroneously just focused on stopping emissions. You know, that we have to stop emissions, and of course we do. We have to stop emissions. We have to move towards renewable energy. We have to do all of that. But still, even if we stopped all fossil fuel emissions today, right now, there would still be that legacy load of carbon dioxide in the air. So we have to get it down. We have to do something to draw it down. And the best way to draw it down is by employing plants, you know, is by revegetating the world, all these places that we have left barren, all these places that we've ruined through bad agriculture, you know, in that 10,000 year period where humans have been practicing agriculture, you know, a lot of it has been very bad agriculture that has left land really sick and barren of carbon. So we need to revegetate those millions of acres around the world that have had the carbon stripped from them by bad farming, and we can pull it back down. We can pull that carbon dioxide back down out of the atmosphere and get it back into the soil where it belongs.
What do you see happening within the next 10 years, and what do you find particularly hopeful about it?
Well, I really am. After writing this book, I really did become hopeful, and I used to be not hopeful. You know, I used to look at our climate dilemma and, you know, the amount of environmental degradation that's happening all over the world. I used to be just so depressed about that because it just seemed like we had to take really extraordinary steps to try to turn that around, and it seemed like nobody was taking the steps, or at least not in big enough, meaningful enough ways. And after discovering this soil health movement that's going on, I really became very hopeful. You know, I think that the Earth is a lot more resilient than we realize. I think that the thing that's so exciting about understanding that these soil microorganisms are there and they're working not for us, they're not really aware of us, but they are working in our behalf in terms of continuing to make the world that we evolved into as a species. You know, that's the world that we evolved into, was the one that plants and soil microorganisms created. And we've been completely unaware that they were part of the equation until really very recently. So I think now that we understand that our ecosystem has this whole other component, it's like half of our ecosystem that we didn't know about, and oh my God, there it is right underneath our feet. I think that we can be more mindful about how we use the land. And as I said, there are practitioners that are already showing the way, there are farmers that are already showing the way, how we can really dramatically change the way we use our land so that it's healthier. And it just, there's kind of like a no downside, at least for, I mean, there's a downside for the agrochemical businesses, but there is no downside for the rest of us. You know, if agriculture changes so that it's really focused on soil health, it not only captures more carbon in the soil, but it also is more drought resilient and it is more erosion resilient. So that means that streams aren't getting nastied up every time it rains and with a runoff of agricultural chemicals and loose soil. It means that the air is going to be cleaner because, again, the soil is going to be held together more by that carbon glue that the microorganisms create. I mean, there's just so many implications for our planet by this healthy soil movement that it makes me very hopeful. You know, agriculture is the biggest way that humans have an impact on our environment. And if we can start to turn that from being a harmful impact, which it mainly is right now, to a healing impact, I think that's got tremendous potential.
That was Kristen Olson discussing her book, The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. Next, we have Richard Satnick in the studio. Richard opened Laughing Planet nearly 20 years ago and more recently opened Dick's Kitchen. Richard started Dick's Kitchen to share the food and recipes that he discovered while researching his nutritional and dietary needs. The restaurant strives for genuine sustainability and partners with food purveyors who are active in the holistic food movement. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So tell us a bit about yourself and how you were inspired to start Dick's Kitchen.
Really, I was inspired by an asterisk on a list of foods that I wasn't supposed to be eating to address my own health concerns, my own health issues. And the asterisk was next to the list and was beef. And the asterisk said, unless it's 100% grass-fed beef, you shouldn't be eating conventionally raised beef with my nutritional and health needs. And in general, this is probably the case. In researching that asterisk, I found out that what grass-fed beef could be doing, and it's really the connection to the previous piece, because it's all about raising food in a way that creates health both for us as well as for the planet. So I was inspired when, at the same time as I was reading and researching my own health needs, to find people in here in Oregon that are raising beef in a way that's much more more traditional, more like the permacultural needs that we should be addressing. And so we decided, after having started Laughing Planet, to be more of a vegetarian thing with Dick's Kitchen. We decided to jump right in and do the beef from Carmen Ranch, one of the leaders in sustainable ranching, and figuring out how to use Dick's Kitchen as a platform to both serve healthier food, but to convince people that we needed to think about how we were raising our food as much as what we were putting in our mouths.
So what does this sustainable ranching look like?
Well, as Kristen talks about, and as many people talk about, it has to do with using the model, the Pleistocene model of how animals mob graze. It has to do with not looking at annual agriculture as the solution to all our problems, and rewilding our farms to create real permacultural systems. I've learned about that, and it's been a whole process. It's been an ongoing journey to figure out how what we eat and how it's raised are connected to our health as well as the planet's health.
So you are at your restaurant, you like to partner with people in the holistic food movement. So part of that is the sustainable ranching. But what else does the holistic food movement encompass?
Well, it's actually a very complex set of strands, some of it having to do with the way we're looking at nutrition now, which suggests that our older notions that we learned in the 70s and 80s have changed. Things like the quality of fat we are now supposed to be eating, where, you know, when I was in college and afterwards, eating any fat at all was probably considered a form of evil. And now we realize that if the essential fatty acid spectrum tends toward the omega-3 side, that you're getting a huge benefit. In fact, it's essential. That's why they're called essential fatty acids. We have to do those. And we have to eat in ways that are in accord with our ancestral patterns, for lack of a better term. And there are, when you say the holistic food movement, it really is a whole set of different things going on at the same time, whether it's the permaculture or the soil movement that Kristen described so beautifully. There's just so many things going on. And it includes, for instance, the paleo idea that we should be eating in a way that's like our ancestral diet.
So let's talk a little bit more about grass-fed beef. What is the difference between the grass-fed beef and more of the industrial-raised?
Well, the industrial beef, cattle are confined in feedlots and fed diets that are not their normal evolutionary diet. These are things that eventually make the cattle sick, and you then have to add antibiotics and other things into their diet in order to try to get them to maximum weight and get them, you know, butchered and into the supermarkets. Grass-fed has a different model, which basically says, let's look at the way herbivores in nature do things and let animals eat what they're supposed to eat at the pace they should be eating. They can pretty much manage things. We're very lucky that here in Oregon, we have a lot of people paying attention to this paradigm, and we can in fact source food that has been raised this way. So we're lucky, and it's a extremely important distinction between feedlot cattle, which will end up being very high in the omega-6 fatty acids, versus free range or the kind of permacultural cattle raising that our rancher pursues, that creates more omega-3s and therefore is a much healthier product.
So, and then there's grass-fed cattle, and then you can even take it to the next step with the really holistic range management, changing like the areas that the cattle graze on every couple days. Do you know much about this?
Well, this just suggests that you move, that you allow the cattle to move around in a way that, or you force the cattle to move around in a way that mimics what they would be doing in their natural state if they were normal herbivores. Both predation and where all the juicy stuff is tends to keep them moving, and they cluster and for defensive purposes, and disturb the soil in ways that Kristen described. You know, these are all things that create real ecosystems, or allow you to raise food within an ecosystem paradigm, rather than trying to use an industrial model of forcing everything to be both consistent and predictable and all that. Nature doesn't quite do it that way.
So the industrial method, big ag and conventional farming, they ignore this relationship with the soil. They use methods that kill the microorganisms. But there does seem to be a movement that's spreading for healthy practices. Have you seen this movement spreading since you've been involved in it?
Oh yeah, it's gathering some momentum. The question is whether we can increase the momentum, whether we can spread it from the areas like Oregon, where it's more prevalent, than into places like the Great Midwest, where you still have monoculture and vast fields of corn and soybeans. So yes, it is picking up steam. It needs to pick up a lot more steam quickly, because we have destroyed an awful lot of our agricultural, the heritage we already have, and we can restore it if we follow some of the methods described by Kristen.
So how do you think we can shift into these different practices?
Well, it probably has to begin with consumers demanding that food be raised in an appropriate way. And we're beginning to see this. We're beginning to see grass-fed beef as a positive label that people will be seeking, as I've been told to seek. So there is progress on this. It's going to take a lot more education. We have to spend some time understanding books like Kristen's book and all of the issues that she raises. They're crucial. And the relationship of what she talks about to how we eat is essential for us to learn more about. So if we challenge ourselves to keep learning, and challenge ourselves and challenge our restaurateurs to source their food appropriately, we've got a shot at it. Industry will listen, but they won't lead.
So what have you found particularly inspiring on your journey?
Well, all you have to do is go visit Corey Carmen at her ranch in Eastern Oregon, and realize that she turns her cows out into the mountains in the winter, and they all come running back in the spring without any of the coercive methods you think of with ranching. That's pretty inspirational. It's also gorgeous country, and you realize that you can produce incredibly delicious food that will help us heal some of the mistakes we've made as a species. So that part of it is very inspiring.
So
delicious.
You brought a book with you into the studio that you said you nearly almost fell over when you were reading it.
Yes, this is a book called Restoration Agriculture by Mark Shepherd, and I just can't say enough about how important this book is. It really did encapsulate everything we're doing wrong as a civilization, and it also encapsulates all that we should be doing and that we can be doing in raising food differently. He himself is a farmer, so I heartily recommend anybody who's interested in the restoration and agriculture movement read his book and be prepared to be shocked and amazed, and ultimately to develop a hopeful sense of the future, because we do know what to do differently. The question is whether we can do it on a scale that makes sense.
All right. Well, we have time for one more short question. So what do you feel is most important for us to consider as consumers when we go about our everyday lives eating?
We have to know how is our food being raised, not just what are the ingredients, important stuff, whether it's organic and all of that. That's very important. But what are the practices that led to that particular food item that you're putting in your mouth? The more we understand about that, the more we reconnect to how food is actually raised, the better chance we have of figuring things out.
All right. Well, thank you, Richard, for joining us today on The Food Show.
You bet.
That was Richard Satnick of Dick's Kitchen speaking about the holistic food movement. Next up, Portland is full of amazing pop-up dining opportunities. One of these is Secret Restaurant, which has been hosting homemade communal-themed dinners for several years now. Chris recently talked with Andrew Barton and Peter Schweitzer from Secret Restaurant to talk about a new project. They are taking some of their favorite recipes and, along with Peter's wife and food stylist Kate Schweitzer, have turned them into a cookbook that they are independently releasing. They recently finished a successful Kickstarter campaign to gain funding for the project, which is going to be called Myrtlewood, Home Cooking from the Pacific Northwest. Chris interviewed Andrew and Peter at the KBOO Studios here in Portland.
Where did the cookbook idea come from? I know you guys have been doing Secret Restaurant for a while. Was it just sort of the logical next step?
Yeah, I feel like I started out photographing Secret Restaurant a few years ago with Andrew, and as we progressed through and we saw these, you know, the photos were turning out better and better each time, it was kind of a logical progression for both of us. I think I had really come to love food photography, and I wanted a project that was more defined and had a start and finish. And I think Andrew at the same time had been really wanting to do a project like this for a while. So it was a very natural collaboration that came together very easily.
Well, and tell me, so you've been shooting from the very beginning. Was this always on the back burner? Like, this was always an idea that could potentially happen, or were you just shooting and for giggles and then you're like, oh, I have all these photos, let's make this happen?
Well, I had this one recipe that had traveled around a little bit. Like, I had made it for a friend. They'd asked for the recipe. I'd sent them the recipe. They had passed it along, served it to a bunch of people, and then continued to pass it along. So I basically knew that this one recipe had been tested several times and was really, really something worth sharing. And so we kind of casually thought about submitting that recipe and some photographs to a literary magazine. And so Kate and Peter came over, shot the dish, ate the food, and that was our first shoot. It was kind of like, we didn't know we were doing the whole project when we did that first shoot, but everything yeah. about the look and the tastes and the process.
Well, it turned out so much, I think, even better than all the Secret Restaurant shoots we've done in the past, because those are so kind of on a time crunch. You have the people around, you're shooting in the moment, whereas we were able to step back and sit in the kitchen together and shoot these beautiful photographs and just kind of really dig into the recipe and the food. And so after completing that and us all sitting down to look at the images, we were like, wow, this is something special. And we wanted to go further with that and continue. And so that's when the idea of the cookbook came up.
Well, I want to talk about the approach to photographing these events. I mean, do you feel like you're more a people photographer or a food photographer, or I guess it's a hybrid of the two?
It definitely is. I really enjoy capturing the mood of Secret Restaurant and kind of the evening. It's definitely, you know, being in the evening, kind of I love taking photos of the people enjoying the food and just all gathered around the table. But then at the same time, really focusing on each dish and the food and just, like you said, a hybrid of those things. And so I really have been, you know, starting out, I wasn't sure if I would love food photography, but I really, after a couple years or a couple of these secret restaurant dinners, I really, really enjoyed it, and it really turned into a
now Peter's documentation of the secret restaurants is pretty cinematic. It's like you look at the beginning of the photos and it sets the place, it sets the mood, then you see the people arrive, and then every dish gets a vivid representation as well. So it's pretty incredible to see.
Well, you have all this documentation of the dinners from the beginning till now. What, when you're looking at those images, what is the evolution of the project?
I think it's just sort of naturally refined. It's sort of become more of its own thing. I think Secret Restaurant Portland now can kind of confidently exist in the world of projects like it, and really distinctly have kind of its own angle, its own spirit, and both aesthetically and the tastes and the sourcing and everything else that goes into it.
Yeah, I feel like Secret Restaurant is definitely its own thing compared to the cookbook. It's definitely a very, it's, like Andrew said, it's coming to its own. You know, I think we've done 60 dinners now, so it's a very big project, but it's kind of indefinitely there. It's a project that continues to go every month, whereas the cookbook is definitely a different mood from that. It's stepping back and taking, being able to relax and really find our own art in each recipe was amazing. I feel like we were, you know, we would sit down each evening after taking these photos and cooking and eat together and kind of just come together in community and enjoy that and not just shoot the recipe and run off afterwards. And so it was, I don't know, it was a good process. I feel like they are definitely two very distinct projects.
Well, and sticking with Secret Restaurant itself, you guys have done 60 some dinners. What keeps you motivated to continue putting them on?
I think just the constraint that we've put upon ourselves to only do it at that frequency and under those terms. I'm not sure. I'm sure that there are some supper clubs out there that have continued on this long, but most of them end up turning into a restaurant, or the people lose interest or move on. And I sort of committed myself, at least in founding the project, to doing it pretty much indefinitely, regardless of where I was living or who I was with or around, because setting those goals and challenges for just like, oh, what are we going to do this time? Where is it going to be? Who's going to be there? What's it going to look like? What theme? What ingredients? And only having that one night is kind of like throwing the big night just once and then doing a different big night the next time. And so that to me is just infinitely interesting.
It just keeps it fresh.
Yeah. And I think that one thing I always remember is that, you know, we're not super strict about having one every single month. I think we've set a pretty good precedent that if it's not fun, we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And so we really try to step back after each one and really plan out the next one, make sure all our schedules match up, and make sure that we're going to do it and have a lot of fun and not walk away burnt out.
Do you ever see it as becoming a job or a business? And it sounds like no, but I don't know, maybe in the future it could evolve that in that direction?
Well, we've definitely thought about what it would be like to sort of become a little bit more widely recognized for the work that we've been doing, because we have just kind of been doing it casually and for free and not making any profit, which we're interested in sort of keeping that spirit. But I think a lot of food bloggers kind of quickly go towards that, like money-making, like advertisements, they get a book deal, kind of thing like that. And part of our motivation for making this cookbook was not wanting to wait around for that to get offered to us. We didn't really want like somebody to come and say, hey, we want to do like a secret restaurant themed book, here's these terms. We just kind of wanted to do what the art that we wanted to make, the art that we wanted to make,
yeah,
on our own terms.
Yeah, which is I think why we started the cookbook. But
with, and that's how Secret Restaurant will continue,
I yeah think. And as the cookbook kind of diverged and became its own thing, we're able to continue a Secret Restaurant and continue to offer, you know, this inexpensive option to people, so that anyone can have the accessible, like, beautiful, delicious meal and not turn it into, you know, a $150 plate type thing.
I've long felt like I'm not interested in pursuing like a restaurant career, but that I would want to do, if it ever came into something that would be sort of a professional venture, that I would want to do it entirely on my own terms, the way that I've done Secret Restaurant so far and the way that we've made this cookbook together.
Well, let's get a little bit deeper into the cookbook itself. Talking about where it came from, I mean, it seems like it is kind of a natural progression, but it is also, it's a leap from the work you guys have been doing. So what was the motivation to put together the cookbook?
Well, I've been reading cookbooks extensively for a while, probably starting around the time that I started Secret Restaurant. I think a lot of the people I would cite as influences now I didn't know about when I started Secret Restaurant. I work as a preschool teacher, and around the holidays and end of the year, I would really get a lot of Powell's gift cards. Powell's being the giant bookstore in Portland, for those who aren't in Portland. And so I started collecting cookbooks and just reading a great number of them and becoming more and more interested in them, learning so much from them, that the ambition kind of secretly grew inside of me to do one.
Yeah, and from the photography standpoint, I really wanted to have a project that was really defined and had a beginning and end, and be able to come up with this beautiful like piece of work that I could have pulled together. And so I feel like it was definitely very ambitious for both of us to come and pull this together, but I think that we felt it was the right time. And after having so many good experiences at Secret Restaurant and having such a good, you know, a good time, amount of time behind us, we felt confident in moving forward and working on this together.
Yeah, I really wanted this opportunity kind of for myself to grow as a writer and a cook, and then also for Peter as a photographer, both in the process of working in and the end result potentially being something that could be sort of career making for him, because there's this like distinct evidence of the work by making like a finished and distributable product.
Yeah.
So you guys have named the cookbook Myrtlewood. What's the deal with that name?
Well, Myrtlewood is this very beautiful, it comes from this very beautiful tree that only is known to exist kind of between the Central Oregon coast and down to Northern California. And the town where it first appears, Florence, or outside of there, is a place where I spent a lot of childhood summers. So I had that kind of immediate connection to it once I sort of heard about it for the first time. And there's a lot of culinary uses of the wood. It's known for making really exceptionally durable and beautiful cutting boards, plates, bowls. For a while, it was sort of like an Oregon tourist gift thing, like take home a Myrtlewood box or a Myrtlewood plate when you visit the Oregon coast. And so something about that, and that I was already eating off of Myrtlewood plates consistently, really popped out to me. Like my dad asked me, what's it going to be called? Like when I first told him that I was going to do it, because he's all about thinking about that in the future. Wasn't really that antagonistic, but he asked me pretty directly. And that was the first thing that came to mind. And so we stuck with it.
Well, and you've talked about you're on your own terms a lot, and you're definitely going that route with the cookbook. So talk about this. You've started a Kickstarter campaign, and you're looking to sort of independently publish this first round of the cookbook. Talk about that process.
I feel like we, about halfway through the process of creating the cookbook, we kind of were throwing around ideas of how we should get this out there to people. And when we came down to it, we really decided that being able to publish this first edition ourselves was really important to us. We wanted to see the cookbook all the way through to the end. We wanted to have this, our vision, all the way through to the finished hard copy. We didn't want to be able to, you know, we didn't want to finish shooting all these recipes and creating all this content and then give it off to somebody else to turn into their vision. So I think that it was really important to us to remain independent, and so the Kickstarter was a very natural progression of that.
We knew we had the skill set to pull it off. I think, I mean, I run another sort of hobby side project is I run a small press distributing like little books of poetry and travel writing and food writing and short fiction, and so I've been doing book design for a really long time. We've designed the all of the kind of look of Secret Restaurant, menus, website, all of that for so long. Peter shot the video. We put together all the press materials, all these things that similar projects have a fleet of people working for them. We did all of it ourselves.
Yeah. And my wife, Kate, she's been a big part of this project as well, and she has basically handled all the styling of the each dish as we create it. And so I think she's been a big confidence booster for both of us, because she can come in, give us advice on how she wants it to look, and then pull it together. And she's kind of like the glue that pulls it, everything together. She definitely
really important figure in all of the elements, basically, when we were creating it and in the post-production. She's really helped, a very good project manager. And everything, yeah. She keeps us on a schedule.
Well, it really does sound like you guys have, your skills have grown as you've started this project and then seen it throughout the years. And right, this is that culmination of those. It's all kind of ephemeral, having these dinners and you have these experiences. But this is going to be the like physical version. Like, you can hold this thing that represents the skills and experiences that you've had over the years.
Yeah, that was really important to us.
And we wanted to make it, I mean, one of the things that does set it aside from Secret Restaurant is the content of the food, really. I mean, I think Secret Restaurant is often ambitious kind of restaurant-y food. Sometimes it's really casual and rustic and what have you, but in this, it was more, it really did come from what I like to eat at home. Influences from around the world, as far as the style, but then also really kind of trying to think of it as like a Pacific Northwest thing, so bringing it back home pretty consistently. Yeah. And it was really nice to sort of do that this time.
Yeah, I feel like it was very, it's been a learning process for me with food, having been a part of this. I feel like Secret Restaurant, like Andrew said, is a very restaurant-y, like, it can be, you know, you're putting on this dinner for 10 to 15 or more people. And so it's definitely a different feeling, whereas with our, the meals we're creating with the cookbook are very accessible to anybody cooking. I mean, I never cook from home, and this has brought a whole different side of that for me. I feel like I am way more comfortable now going and trying so many new things in my own kitchen.
Andrew and Peter, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You are listening to The Food Show on KBOO. That was Andrew Barton and Peter Schweitzer from Secret Restaurant talking about their new cookbook, Myrtlewood. Annie Moss has been involved in improving and expanding the regional grain economy in both New York and Oregon. She was baking at Tabor Bread and, with the help of her partner, Katya Bizarra Clark, has made the leap to running her own operation in Northeast Portland called Sea Star Bakery. At Sea Star, they source as much of the grains for their products regionally, oftentimes buying the whole grains directly from the farmer and milling them in the shop. They also have an interesting model, sharing the space and the wood-burning stove with Handsome Pizza, who takes over in the afternoon. Chris interviewed Annie at Sea Star Bakery the day before they had their opening. Here's that interview.
So what's going to set Sea Star Bakery apart from other bakeries around town?
I think, well, one thing that's going to... So I came... My partner, Katya, and I both came from Tabor Bread. I was the general manager there, and Katya was the chef and kitchen manager. And Tabor Bread is... you know, probably many people know, focuses on local grains and milling in-house. Sea Star Bakery is definitely in that same vein, shares similar values. I think one thing that's going to set us apart is fun and a little bit of just weirdness. We talk a lot in our team about sort of how, you know, Portland's supposed to be weird, but sometimes it feels like that element is getting overshadowed by other, you know, other things, and we're really excited to kind of be weird and community oriented and inclusive in our space. And then as far as the food goes, I think it's just a sort of a serendipitous or magical combination of you know, beautiful and tasty and you know, quality ingredients, but also approachable and low key and not overly fussy.
So you were working at Tabor Bread. How'd you make the leap? How'd you decide that it was time to start your own bakery?
Well, Katya and I went to graduate school in New York City together. That's actually how we knew each other. And we always had this fantasy there that we would someday move to Portland and open a cafe. And Tabor Bread was, you know, the landing place for both of us when we moved to the city. And we worked there for several years. And it just kind of started to feel like, I don't know. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I think actually what it was is I got a phone call from, it might have been like the the farmer's market manager of the Oregon City Farmer's Market. And she was calling Tabor Bread and she was like, does Tabor Bread want to open a branch in Oregon City? And I've always had this weird fascination with Oregon City. I think it's, I worked on a project there when I first moved to Portland and I think it's kind of a cool place. And she said, there's a space opening up. It'd be perfect if Tabor Bread wants to, you know, open a second branch. And the market, like people in Oregon City just really want your product. And Tabor Bread wasn't really in, you know, the owner of Tabor Bread, she wasn't really looking to open another outpost. And Katya and I were like, let's just go down and check it out and see what's up. And at the same time, Will, who's the owner of Hanson Pizza and now one of our business partners, he was looking to relocate his business, the lot that he was operating his pizzeria out of. He was in a converted garage and they were developing that lot. So we were going to tear down the garage. So he was looking for a new space. He knew we were sort of starting, just really sort of like almost on a whim, starting to look for our own space. And he was finding spaces that were significantly larger than his tiny converted garage. And he knew he was going to have to add a product line or, you know, some you know, flesh out his offerings a little bit. And he and his business partner, Matt, just approached Katya and I. I mean, Matt's really, really into bread and baking, really into local grains. So the sort of all four of us had this like thread that we shared in our values and our aesthetics. And I think having those two guys and sort of being part of a group and having some momentum of like an already existing business really helped pull us into it and just be ready to take the plunge.
And talk about how that's going to work. Two businesses in one space. So I feel like it's a really interesting model. You get to share the overhead and really maximize the time in the space. But yeah, how's that going to work?
Oh, well, I mean, so far how it's working is a lot of self-awareness and a lot of conversations with each other. And you know, somebody gave me this piece of advice that's like the best piece of advice I've gotten so far. She said, you know, in working with a group, expect disappointment. And I think what she meant by that, and I actually think it's a beautiful message. It's not at all like, it's not a bad thing. It's just expect that you're not always going to get your way. And so that's been something I think that we've all found our own way of coping with. And then in terms of logistics, it just really like, I think the biggest thing is the wood-fired oven. I don't know if I mentioned that our pizza's wood-fired and our bread is wood-fired and all of our breakfast toast offerings are going to be cooked in that wood-fired oven. So the biggest piece that we're totally learning right now, kind of on the fly, is how the logistics of the oven heat work. And yeah, for people who've worked in a wood-fired oven before, it's definitely like, you know, you have to balance the kind of consistency and regularity and routine of a restaurant with the unpredictability of elements of wood. And you know, like the volume that you make in a day will change the heat of the oven, and the number of hours between, you know, one firing and the next baking will change the heat of the oven. So I think that's going to be a big piece of the logistics. And then also it just gives us all a chance to kind of like have our place to shine. Like none of us really has to, I think we all want to be able to do everything just so that we can give each other a break now and then, but we can each kind of like dig in and use our strengths where they make sense and then share what's needed with the others to be able to kind of like take, you know, help us out.
It sounds like since it has now just opened, there, in the next few days, you're going to be learning a whole lot about this operation.
I think like the next few months, we're going to be learning a lot. I'm thinking like the first 6 months are just going to be awkward and not like unpleasant. I think we'll give great customer service. I think we'll make beautiful food. I think it'll be fun and pleasant to be there. But I think 6 months from now, we'll look back and we'll just be like, oh my God, I can't believe that's how we thought we were going to do that.
So I want to go a little bit big picture, and you've talked about in the story, your sort of work with grains. And I want to know what you want to see for the regional grain economy here in Portland.
I mean, I've been really excited to see what's happening already with the regional grain economy around. I mean, I think there's a lot of, there are like a surprising number of small farmers who we can reach out to and source products from. And, you know, they're surprisingly accommodating of the needs of a restaurant. It's one thing to grow a small amount of grains and sell them at market, but to you know, be willing to deliver them wholesale for a handful of them to have mills, I think, or access to mills is a big deal. But I think the more kind of middle level infrastructure there is, the easier it's going to be for those connections to be made between farmers and restaurants or consumers. So, you know, we have a mill in our space because we want to be able to use freshly milled grain and because we want to be able to work with, you know, perhaps a greater diversity of scaled farmers than just like the big ones or the medium size, you know, bigger medium sized ones who have access to mills. But honestly, like, that's a level of dust and like labor that it'd be really cool to see that slightly more centralized. I think there's sort of like, you know, there's like the industrialization and then the backlash is like sort of pretty DIY. And then somewhere in between, I think there's a really sweet spot that might happen where everybody just has more access to fresh flour, local grains. And I think for people to start, like for consumers to start making the connection of why, you know, it's not just like a sort of, I don't know, like moralistic imperative to eat local grains. I mean, they're also just like, they're so flavorful. Like a pastry made with whole grain has texture and it has color and it has flavor that really, like, to me, makes it feel more nourishing, taste more interesting, and look more kind of radiant on the plate.
So you're obviously going to be an aggressive user of regional grains. Do you see the bakery or yourself, your role in the economy as something more? Like, you talked about sort of advocating, but what else do you want to accomplish?
I mean, I think that the best thing I can hope to do is to give people a really positive association with whole grains. And I think that the best way to do that is to just let them have the experience. I love talking about local grains. I love sharing my story. I love talking to other people about it and you know, scheming. But I think change seems to happen the most often when it's fun or when it's useful or makes you feel good in some way. So I think really that's like kind of the best thing we can hope to do. And then I think influencing other businesses might be a way that you know, we can use more like advocacy, I think, could be stronger in that respect because businesses are always listening to each other and looking for ideas and sharing ideas in Portland. That's one of the things I love about working in a small business here. So like, as far as consumers are concerned, I'm happy to have the conversation with anybody, but really I just want to feed them awesome food.
And then it sounds like the more, you know, C-star bakeries there are, the more grains are being sourced, the more regional infrastructure is being created. So
hopefully, yeah, hopefully. And the thing, I mean, the thing that's super like humbling and exciting to me is that there's like a whole, I'm sure that there are so many ways that that food system is going to develop and things that could be innovated and created that I haven't even dreamt of. Like I have some experience and some insight, but I just imagine that like there are things that haven't even occurred to me that could really like set that regional grain economy on a really exciting path.
So I know right now you're just thinking about getting the doors open, getting customers through the door.
Getting our oven functioning.
getting your oven functioning, exactly. Getting that phone call about the convection oven.
Yep.
So you're thinking, your mind's kind of on those little focus things, but big picture, what do you want to see happen with the bakery over time?
Oh, I want us all to work sane hours so badly. I really hope that we can all have just like healthy, balanced lives and still make this thing work. I don't think any of us are gonna make a ton of money. And I think that the other thing that I really wanna see is for the four of us as owners, Katia, Matt, and Will and I as owners, and then all of our employees to just really like find the thing at the bakery that, you know, lights the fire for their next step. That's something I learned at Tabor Bread. Tissa, the owner at Tabor Bread, is just like, she understands that everything we do is on the path to the next thing. And if we can be a business that helps our employees find that skill, find that interest, you know, or just make space in their brains while they figure out what's next. You know, I want people to work for us long term, but I only expect them to work for us long term if they're being satisfied. And I think that's the same for us as owners. Like, I think we'll all stay in it longer if we keep learning or achieving some life goal that we have.
Well, and I want to ask you, you've been baking for a while, and you know, baking is sort of a science. You kind of come in and you get it dialed in, and then you repeat it mm-hmm. over and over and over again. What keeps you inspired to keep going and keep baking?
I mean, I think one thing is management. I am a total management nerd. Like, I love managing a business and all of the challenges that come along with that. Baking is very routine, and it's balanced really nicely by the total wild unpredictability of running a business, especially a restaurant. So I think that's part of it. It's really thrilling to see people pay money for the food that I make. And that's, you know, not so much like because I'm a huge capitalist, but more just because like it really, it validates what we're doing. And then the part that, I mean, I love, like, baking is a science, and there can be sort of some tedious aspects to that, but the finishing of a baked good, like how you, I mean, there's the part before that's like imagining it. So how are we going to make this product different? What flavors are we excited about today? And then on the other end, when it comes out of the oven, like what can I do to this now to really like make it stand out? What shape can it be? What can go, you know, what garnish can it get? How can it be displayed? It's an art form, and all of us have, you know, all four of us, Katya, Will, and Matt, and I have some sort of like creative background, and so I think that like there's a huge element of that for us, is just like creating something beautiful and functional.
Well, Annie, I hope you get your convection oven fixed.
Thank you.
Sooner rather than later, and I hope that C-Star Bakery is wildly successful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. That was Annie Moss, baker and co-owner of C-Star Bakery. That's it for this episode of The KBOO Food Show. I want to thank our guests, Kristen Olson, Richard Satnick, Andrew Barton, Peter Schweitzer, and Annie Moss for being on today's show. I also want to thank our board operator, Tammy. Stay with us for Jazz Lives this afternoon, and don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of June September for another episode. Until then, I'm Rachel Bennett. Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Just because you know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food, working those lands for corporate. People no good, 'cause people need food.